This Tuesday night series will be an attempt to give a shape to Taoism that it has not received before. And the basic background structure, the spine of the skeleton, is going to be Joseph Needham's great series of books. There are now, I think, 11 individual volumes. Some of them are different parts of the same numbered volume. Volume 5, for instance, has 5 different parts, each having its own book. But it's nearing completion, and I expect that sometime this year or early next year that it will be complete. And so this is an opportune time to make a sachet, as they used to say, through his work. This gives us, for the first time, us meaning human beings, because the Chinese have never had this for themselves either. It gives us, for the first time, a chance to see Chinese civilization as a whole, as a single occurrence, spanning many thousands of years, at least 5,000 years of proverbial recorded history, but actually all of the human experience in China, and has been profound. And I rather suspect that the experience, the exposure to the experience of the civilization of China as a unity will produce in the 21st century the kind of renaissance that came when we were able, our distant forebears, were able to view the Greek and Roman experience in the early 15th century as a unity. It gave them an advantage that no one had ever had before, to have a complete civilization available to them for comparison, one which was quite other than the one that they were participating in. And we know from that experience that they were able to integrate themselves back into the Greco-Roman tradition, enough so that that tradition lived again and still lives. So I think that the Chinese experience is now going to be available for a real renaissance coming up. So we're harbingers, in a way. We're sort of like those who have come into the theater before they've even issued tickets to observe not only the Chinese, but the effect upon ourselves. And I think that some of you who have been coming to the Thursday night series long enough got a little bit of the flavor, because I took it historically as much as I could. Now I'm going to take it somewhat thematically, and tonight we'll set the stage. The first volume of Science and Civilization in China came out in 1954, published by Cambridge at the University Press. And it had been in the making for quite some time. It's dedicated to an apothecary from the city of Nanjing, Lu Shikuo. And Lu Shikuo was, in fact, a friend of my mentor, Gai Yushu. So there is some connection there. The volume is entitled Introductory Orientations. And as Needham sets the stage, he gives us a plan of the work and tells us that for the first time he is going to take one by one, thematically, all of the sciences. And of course, when he laid that plan of the work out in the 1940s, no one knew what the disproportions of information we're going to do to swell certain parts and to leave other parts rather small. By far, the largest single unit is on alchemy. At least two and almost three of these 11 volumes are on alchemy. That the experience of Chinese science, which is largely Taoist, as you must suspect by now, was extraordinarily fruitful in alchemy. But there are, in fact, two parallel lines that from time to time braid together in talented individuals, but largely develop autonomously in Chinese alchemy. One of them deals with herbs, and one of them deals with metals. And only occasionally in Chinese history do you find someone who is grandly capable of bringing the botanical and the metallurgical elements together in a single personality. And we will see that the Chinese botanical investigations are the best that have ever been done. That Chinese herbals are the most sophisticated in the world. And where the West seems to have edged ahead in the physics and chemistry of metals, we are still way behind in terms of understanding the properties and uses of herbs. Needham then sets the plan of the work, gives us a tremendous bibliographical précis as to what is available, and again the implicit refrain is that no one knows. No one really knows. And then he gives us a geographical introduction to China and shows us how China is extraordinarily difficult to unify. That unlike Europe, China is crisscrossed by enormous mountain ranges, and there are pockets of different cultures spread all over China, and the only place really in China that was large enough to entertain a civilization-sized culture was the North China Plain. And it's there, north of the Huanghou, north of the Yellow River, that the first developments from Paleolithic times began to develop into village structures. For a long time, it was considered that the Chinese experience before the Han Dynasty was largely mythological, and that such early dynasties as the Shang, or even earlier the Xia, were simply legendary. But in the 1930s, archaeologists found the capital of the Shang Dynasty, Anyang, which is in the northern part of Anhui Province, very much on a line. If you would draw a line from Beijing down to the Huanghou, and then a line from the Pacific Ocean in meeting that line perpendicular about halfway, Anyang is roughly in that geographical setting. To date, archaeology at Anyang has unearthed some 200,000 fragments of inscriptions. But unlike the shards that we have from the Middle East that are pottery shards, the shards at Anyang are bone fragments, almost no pottery. There is some pottery, but almost none in comparison with the hundreds of thousands of fragments of bone. And all of these bone fragments are have writing on them, early Chinese writing. And all of this writing concerns itself with divinations. And so this huge mountain of evidence, the whole literary corpus of the Shang civilization, which is the root now for our Chinese experience, for our understanding of how Taoism comes to be. When a civilization is divining, what are they asking? Or perhaps better, who are they asking? They're not asking themselves for information. They're asking instead, at least minimally, what we would call colloquially the universe, what's it going to be like? What is our conditions going to be like tomorrow, the next day, and so forth? What must we do? And as soon as you begin asking these kinds of questions, whether it be to gods or to the universe or to wise persons, in order to receive an answer, you have to have some kind of an orientation of where you are. Where you are in terms of time, because the question and the response have to refer to some kind of a calendar. There has to be some sense of geography. So asking these kinds of questions in a very subtle, precarious mode, as early divination was with these fragments of bones, this bone oracle, required the Shang mentality to develop a very comparatively subtle matrix of understanding, of orientation, of where they were in space and time, and in terms of person. And from the very subtlety, and because they were relatively unsophisticated people, they were not civilized like, over-civilized like we are, and they were not civilized like the Tang or the Han. And so the Shang, in order to comport to this subtle orientation, projected from themselves, as we would say today, projected from themselves to their deceased ancestors, who would then be on the other side, or on an other side from their lives, who would be up somewhere or beyond somewhere, who would be in an affine condition with the universe, with that flow of nature, so that they were asking by their oracle divination, essentially, their own ancestors to contact the flow of nature and to inform them. The term Tao comes from this. The term Tao comes from the way in which this flow, this natural flow, is affine to the quality of spirit that is able to leave this body, leave this condition in time and space, and be at one with nature, at one with the universe. The bringing of that Tao back to man is what the Chinese understand primordially as Te, as power or virtue. It's not power like in the Kung Fu fist, but it's power in having contact with nature in its primordiality, so that one then has an orientation. You know what's going on. But you know, not in a kind of a database information or in a kind of logical information, but you know only in the sense of participating in the understanding of how the Tao is going to be flowing and how you are going to be able to comport to this. And later on, this matching together will be what the Chinese understand as Li, as principle. That Li principle is not an intellectual principle, but it's a matching, a harmonizing of your pattern, your planning, with the way in which all patterns and all plans can have efficacious functioning. So we have three of the basic terms of Chinese civilization. We have a Tao, which is mysterious, but not mysterious in an ambiguous way, but mysterious in the sense of its comprehensiveness. And the way to contact it is through the ancestors. And that the ancestors bring that information in, not as data, but as an affinity with the Tao. And they're able to project that back to us, and that's the te, the virtue that comes. And that then the principle, the li, later on, by which one lives, this will be harmonizing oneself with this. For the understanding, the fulcrum of the divination was always the earth, and the earth is always the quintessence of Chinese thinking. The earth is always the fulcrum, the center. And for the Chinese, there's an understanding here that the earth is a balance point, and that the polarities that extend furthest from the earth are in the one direction, yang, or fire, and in the other direction, yin, or water. So that in a way, earth is a balancing between fire and water. And that fire in its ultimate form is a creative, masculine, yang brightness, and it is balanced by this yin, water, dark, feminine. And that these two always work together, are always in tandem, and the only time that they actually come together is in earth. And so earth becomes a primordial, so that the shaping of earth becomes for the Chinese a primordial experience. And later on we'll see how the development of pyramids in China, geomantic pyramids in China, is very much like the Egyptian or the Mesoamerican experience, or the ancient Neolithic Celtic experience, that this primordiality of mounding the earth, so that as the earth is mounted together and built up, what is natural is to have fire at the top of this, and the earth that is mounted up from where you've taken this, that now depression is filled with water, receives water. So that the primordial image of the fire on the man-made mount in a moat of water becomes a universal symbol of comprehension, that all of this then, all of the elements are aligned. Because fire and water are polarities, because they do not combine so easily and have to be transformed before they can be combined. The yang energy, when it is coming down, transforms from fire. And this is the experience of metals. And the yin, when it is rising and it transforms, the water transforms and it becomes wood. So that wood and metal are the very essence of the transformative nodes of the way in which fire and water transform in order to come closer to meet. And so wood and metal meet in earth. And so the metals are a structure under the earth and the wood is a structure on the earth. And in this way, the polarities, through a transformation, are able to come together and be together, and the earth then becomes a broker, if we can say, a quintessential broker in these energies coming together and forming complements. So that to the Chinese understanding, this five-part elemental function is primordial. And always in the Chinese mind, there is a five-fold energy phase. And the energy phase does not run linearly, but runs in a sigil form, so that whatever pattern there is, the earth is always at the center. That the meeting, the quintessence, is always there in the third place. So if one then has an understanding, sometimes you get different sigils. If you start with metal, for instance, the metal has come from the yang. The metal would be one. And if it's having a relationship in this particular cycle with water, so you would run metal, water, then earth would be there. Then if you went metal, water, earth, then you would have as the next sign your fire, and the next sign would be your wood. And in this way, the sigil type forms of Chinese transformation are understandable in their primordial aspect. What becomes complicated later on is when whole combinations of this are added together. The art of combination has always fascinated man, and the Chinese mind will be prolific, and they will string together energy transformations that literally boggle the mind. In Lao Tzu's Tao Te Ching, we find a presentation of this. In chapter 42 of the Tao Te Ching, Lao Tzu gives us the classic transformations of Tao. And from what we've said now, let's see what Lao Tzu, this is the translation done by Paul Karras and D.T. Suzuki in Chicago in 1898. I like it because for every Chinese character, they give us a word. Or if the character doesn't give us a word, it gives us a punctuation mark, so we can go step by step. Chapter 42 is called Tao Hua, Hua, transformation, Tao's transformation. And it runs like this. Tao Sheng Yi. Tao produces unity. Yi is unity. Yi. One, it means one. It means one not as the numerical one, but unity. Tao produces unity. Unity produces duality. Duality produces Trinity. Trinity produces the 10,000 things. The 10,000 things bear the negative principle and embrace the positive principle. Now notice the five-phase energy cycle here. One runs one, two, three, infinity, yin and yang. Actually, it runs unity, duality, trinity, multiplicity, complementarity. So that the yin and yang are not duality at all. As the glib Japanese or Western mind, you know, most Chinese today are Western educated have Japanese minds. They don't think Chinese at all. When they go to think Taoistically, they think like Zen, and they miss their own culture. The transformation in the Tao Te Ching runs unity, duality, trinity, multiplicity, complementarity. So that complementarity, the yin and the yang, are not duality at all. Duality is a different phase. Duality is in the polarization that comes immediately when unity goes into motion. Perhaps one way to understand how this duality can happen is if I hold a hand up, and we understand this as unity, if I move that hand now, that movement creates a duality because we have the hand as it's still and the hand as it's moving, and that's the duality. It's not that there are two hands. It's that that would be two, and it's a different concept. But to a Taoist, duality is like that, movement and rest. And in fact, if we see it as movement and rest, we have jumped over into complementarity. If we see the hand and the movement as rest and movement, then we're seeing it in terms of yin and yang. But if we see it as unity and the movement of unity, then that is a primordial duality. That we can be aware of the distinction manifest in a duality creates a third element, our awareness of that. And it's the awareness of that that makes the Trinity. Now, in a Trinity, then, we have a hand, and we have it moving, and we have the awareness that the hand and its moving are a duality, and the self-awareness of that is a Trinity. This is the stable base out of which the, quote, 10,000 things are made. The multiplicity is made out of that. Because as soon as you have consciousness and something and its transformation, then you can have lots of differences. But all of the differences, like all of the vibrating motions, all share this yin-yang complementarity. It's all movement and rest. When the self-consciousness is made transparent, when the Trinity aspect of it is somewhat negated by making the consciousness transparent, to the Taoist, this transparency is the state of wu wei, not doing. It's not moving the hand. It's not being aware that the unity is becoming a duality by moving the hand. And so the Trinity aspect is withdrawn by making consciousness pure so that it does not record the image of the movement, and so there is no duality. Thus, the 10,000 things that are made by the admixture of our consciousness are all purified, and thus the yin and the yang, this complementarity, joins with the duality, and we're able to see them together. And thus the Tao is reinstated to us. Lao Tzu then writes this way. Here are Tao's transformations. Tao produces unity. Unity produces duality. Duality produces Trinity. Trinity produces the 10,000 things. The 10,000 things bear the negative principle, yin, and embrace the positive principle. The immaterial vitality thereby makes them harmonious. This immaterial vitality, that's the term that Lao Tzu uses. Tseng, qi. Qi as in energy. Qi as in everybody talks about today, you got to get your qi going. This is that qi. But it's tseng qi. It's the immaterial vitality. So to try to understand it as energy, as 1980s finger snapping, Burbank style Tai Chi, gym teacher master stuff, it misses everything. Is Japanese Neo-Confucianism warmed over in Los Angeles? It's not anywhere near. There's no Tao there. But Lao Tzu is a real master. Even riding on his buffalo, not picking his teeth, he's master. Let's go through this real slow in one motion. Tao's transformations, unity, duality, trinity, multiplicity, complementarity, immaterial vitality thereby makes them harmonious. All of them are harmonious. How do they all become harmonious? They all become harmonious because at the center, at the quintessence of that transformation cycle, the Trinity, what made it a Trinity was the opaque consciousness of man, what takes the Trinity out of that, what takes the earth, the center, out of that, is clarifying consciousness so that it is pure. It's not there. It's wu-wei. So that then the 10,000 things cannot be made, because they're only made up of that. And when you take that element out, they aren't there. So that complementarity and duality resonate together harmoniously. How do they resonate together? They come back to unity immediately, spontaneously. And the Taoist term for that is what we would call just so. The Chinese term is zijian, suchness, some people call it. It's zijian and is also Tao. And so Tao returns to itself, returns to what it is. It couldn't be anything else other than that. As soon as man takes himself out of the equation aspect, which made the multiplicity in the first place, so that the multiplicity doesn't happen, and the complementarity and the duality come back together. And what was the duality? The duality was a hand and its motion. And when we see that as complementary, we see that the hand and its motion is still a unity. Zijian. When the Buddhists came into China and they finally understood that the Chinese understood this without having consulted the Buddha, they were astounded. And the Chinese, when they realized that the astonishment of the Buddhists was because they had understood what they had understood about themselves, they said, well, the Buddha must have been Chinese. Because we're the only people that think this way. And if you think this way, then he was Chinese. Because it's the essential quality of the Chinese consciousness. That you can participate in what we call the real. And you can participate in the nth degree by purifying your participation to the vanishing point by Wu Wei, and everything returns back to Zijian. Everything is spontaneous then. Nothing's happening that isn't spontaneous, and the 10,000 things just are not there. This is Taoism, as opposed to Neo-Confucianism, as opposed to Confucianism, as opposed to Buddhism, as opposed to all the other variations. Now this is very difficult if you're trying to remember it. But if you can practice it, it gets to have a flavor. And so Lao Tzu says, the people, I guess I'm going to skip over here. This is where I want us to be. The person that can do this is not called a Taoist in Lao Tzu. He's called a Shengzhen. Shengzhen, a holy man. It could be a woman. It's just a holy person, holy human being who can do this. Why is he holy? Because the sacred unity of everything is reinstated by his willingness and his understanding that he should do nothing at all, meaning 0000, and that is doing everything and restoring everything back to its unity. So he writes in here, chapter 47, seeing the distant. Not going out of the door, I know the world. Not peeping through the window, I see heaven's Tao. One goes out more and more to the distance, one's knowledge more and more grows little. Why? Because you're getting caught up in the 10,000 things. And if you're caught up in the 10,000 things, what does that effect have on you? It makes your consciousness more and more clouded. You start reacting to those 10,000 things, your consciousness starts thinking that it's got to respond to them. And in fact, the best way to respond is to control them. Or at least to control people who control them. And of course, this is the way of empire. As soon as you start thinking that way, there's no limit. So your knowledge becomes littler and littler. Therefore, the Sheng Jin, the holy man, not goes about, but he knows. Not he sees, but he defines. Not he labors, but he completes. How does he complete? Is complete here, Qing. The completing is that the whole energy cycle, which the Tao comes in with unity and runs through duality, trinity, multiplicity, and complementarity, has to have its complement in being able to return back to unity. That's called completing. Now, the ability in Taoism to do this instantly, I think the computer people talk about nanoseconds. That's too long. Picoseconds, that's too long. Instantly, that whatever is happening and going on, if you find that you're being caught up in the 10,000 things, immediately spontaneous Wu Wei and unity immediately occurring, and then everything is fresh. This is Taoism. And you can see that there's no way to approximate this. One has to either do it or not do it. So Lao Tzu then says, chapter 48, to forget knowledge is this chapter. Wang Qi. Who attends to learning daily, he gains. Who practices Tao daily, he diminishes. Why? Because if you make Tao one of the 10,000 things, then you're going to respond to it with an opaque consciousness as if it were a quality, a thing, a way. And immediately you've cut yourself off from the real practice, and you can't get anything back to unity. Then you're caught up in multiplicity. And the very root of all that multiplicity is your own stubborn Trinitarian, if I can use that term. That's almost a pun now. Your Trinitarian bias. That you can't not do it. And that's the curse. You can't practice Wu Wei. Later on in Taoism, in the Han Dynasty, where this became a real psychological problem for everybody, one of the solutions to this was called pure conversation. Talking with someone with great accuracy and great specificity about nothing. So that it wasn't the point of the conversation was to discuss something, but it was specifically to tune the mind in this repartee, in this dialogue, this pure conversation, to getting back to just that. And this, of course, was the beginning of the training sessions that led to the development of what we call Taoist traditions. Before the Han Dynasty, there were no Taoist traditions. There were no lineages. There were no sects of Taoism. And they came in from this need to find some way to come back. Lao Tzu, in To Forget Knowledge, then, writes, who attends to learning daily, he gains. Who practices Tao daily, he diminishes. He diminishes himself, and again he diminishes. Thus he attains unto Wu Wei, non-doing. He does non-doing, yet there is nothing undone. Now this can be very puzzling if you try to make an ideational pattern out of it. And it becomes paradoxical in that sense. And a lot of the literature that you will run across, sophisticated so-called literature, will speak of Taoism as paradoxical. It isn't paradoxical at all. It's just exactingly specific for a certain practice and a certain tone. And if you can't do it, if you can't practice that, then any speaking of it is truly paradoxical and irresolvable. Now, all this is essential because the development of science and civilization in China is all Taoist. Every bit of it is Taoist. And so when we come to it, in fact, when we look at the outer volume binding of the volumes, what we see on the cover are not instruments, but Taoist genii. And every volume of the series has these Taoist genii on. These nice Taoist genii are very, very, very special. And Needham tells us, here's the picture of the Taoist genii printed on the cover of this book, a part of a painted temple scroll, recent but traditional, given to us here in Sichuan Province, 1946. These four divinities of respectable rank in the Taoist bureaucracy have these titles. The first of the four is the Heavenly Prince, and of the other three, Mysterious Commander. The top is Thien Chun, who's Controller General of Crops and Weather, and before his deification, he was a rain-making magician, and he was born about 340 AD. And his attributes may be seen in the sun and the moon, a measuring rod and a carpenter's square. And the two great luminaries imply the making of the calendar, so important for a primarily agricultural society. And the carpenter's square is no ordinary tool, but the gnomon for measuring the lengths of the sun's solstitial shadows, and so on. And then there, the other ones are described in here, and you can read them for yourself. Taoism undergoes a radical change after the fall of the Han Dynasty, where it became almost a matter of life and death in polarized ways, life and death. Somebody who thought you knew the secrets of the universe, they would do everything they could to get you to tell them. And so they would keep you around for that. If you didn't tell them, they would do you in. Or if they found that you didn't know, they would do you in. So it was damned if you do and damned if you don't. So after the Han Dynasty, it was very important for Taoists who really could practice Wu Wei to obscure the situation, to extend the learning process out so that it was very complicated for anyone to pass all these tests. And they would say, well, it's going to take you several years just to get prepared and ready. And one of the preparations is, can you make gold? And if you can't make gold, well, then we can't give you the secret. Well, of course, it's impossible to make gold alchemically. You can get very close to it in a fanciful way. You can, for instance, make an amalgam out of mercury and gold. You can take a little gram of gold and you can dissolve it in about 5 grams of mercury. And if you add a little bit of lead to this to fix that, and some mineral base to that, a little salt, sal ammoniac, you can actually get the mercury amalgam with gold to congeal and becomes rigid enough that you can actually powder this. And you can